The Tom Woods Show, episode 2339.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. As the academic year winds down, it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do in the fall. And of course, I highly recommend the self-taught K through 12 Ron Paul curriculum. Not only will your kids get the real story about everything, but they'll also learn the kinds of practical things that they won't learn in the traditional school. For instance, how to be an effective public speaker, how to manage money, and how to run your own home business. And of course, when they reach the high school grades, they will be learning Western civilization and U.S. government from old Tom Woods here. But here's the most important thing. If you're going to join, make sure you join through my link, because only through my link do you get $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm about to play for you my interview with Stephen Wolfram, whom I'll introduce you to in a minute. But just a quick word on audio. The Wolfram people wanted to record the program on their end and then send it to me. So I consented to that. So I don't have a local recording of my voice. And so it's gone through Zoom and, of course, been degraded in some way. So obviously it'll be perfectly fine, but it won't be the crisp, beautiful audio coming from my end that we normally have just because of the unusual circumstances. So having said that, I now introduce you to Stephen Wolfram and what I think is a pretty interesting conversation. So here we go. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 2339 of the Tom Woods Show. I'm delighted to have with me Dr. Stephen Wolfram. And Dr. Wolfram, as I was saying before we started, I had a little difficulty coming up with a brief introduction for you. So I am borrowing a bit from the introduction you got on a recent interview of yours that I watched. This has been Stephen Wolfram Day in the Woods household as I've absorbed a great deal of your content. But Dr. Wolfram is a renowned polymath who has left significant contributions to the fields of physics, computer science, and mathematics. He earned a PhD in theoretical physics from the California Institute of Technology by the age of 20 and became the youngest recipient of the prestigious MacArthur Fellowship at the age of 21. His groundbreaking computational tool, Mathematica, was launched in 1988 and has become a cornerstone for researchers and innovators worldwide. In 2002, he published A New Kind of Science, a paradigm-shifting work which explored the foundations of science through the lens of computational systems. In 2007, Wolfram created Wolfram Alpha, a computational knowledge engine utilized by millions of users worldwide. His current focus is on the Wolfram language, which is a powerful programming language designed to democratize access to cutting-edge technology. He's received honorary doctorates and fellowships from prestigious institutions, and he is the author most recently of What is ChatGPT Doing and Why Does It Work? So, Dr. Wolfram, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to be talking today to a lay audience, and I include myself in that. I have a PhD, but it's in history, so no field that helps me in this area whatsoever. So when I first interacted with ChatGPT, for example, I had no idea what I was dealing with. I had never heard of a large language model, and the quality of the responses I was receiving was very, very high compared to what I was expecting. But what was interesting was I did notice interesting limitations to it right off the bat. So I thought I was dealing with something that I could teach things to. I thought I could teach it things. So I started by trying to teach it, so to speak, a couple of children's games. I successfully taught it in quotation marks, a children's game called Fortunately, Unfortunately. So one person says, fortunately, our new neighbors appeared to be very friendly. And then the other person has to come up with unfortunately, and then some over the top horrible aspect of the question, like, unfortunately, this was a mere ruse, and they ended up kidnapping us, or whatever it is. And then you just alternate, continuing the story, fortunately, unfortunately. Had no problem doing that. And I could even tell it, I want your unfortunately to be even more ridiculous than last time. And it would do that. But the other thing I try to teach it was a simple game called Buzz, where the two players alternate saying the integers, beginning, I say one, you say two, I say three. But when you reach a multiple of seven, or a number, one of whose digits is seven, instead of saying the number, you say buzz. And those are all the rules. And so it alternated saying integers with me. But then it would get to seven. I would say buzz. And then, but it got to 14 and it just said 14. And I said, but 14 is a multiple of seven. You should have said buzz. And it apologized to me. But then we would continue on and it would continue to make the mistake.
And I thought, how interesting. Why can't it learn? And the answer, I think, is that I was misunderstanding the nature of what this thing is.
It is a large language model. It deals with language. It is not a thing that computes. And the thing to understand, I mean, first of all, your surprise that it could work was shared by everybody, including its creators, including somebody like me. I'd followed kind of neural nets and even language models for many years. And the fact that we got above this threshold where suddenly this was a thing that was actually producing realistic essays and being able to converse in full sentence human language, that was a surprise to everyone. Now, the question is, what does it ultimately do? Well, what it ultimately does is it knows how to emulate language of the kind that it has seen billions of pages of on the web. And so if you type in the cat on the to ChatGPT, it will almost certainly say Matt as the next word. Why? Because on the web, there were probably hundreds of thousands of sentences that go the cat on the mat. Less likely the cat on the sofa, the cat on the floor, whatever. So what it has done is it's learnt kind of the statistics of the language that exists on the web. But it goes further than that because there aren't enough sentences on the web to be able to know what the next word will be to some complicated thing you say there just isn't an example of on the web. And so it has to have kind of a further model for how to continue text. And the surprise, again, it's an important scientific discovery in a sense, is this idea of a neural net seems to be able to do kind of continuation of language in a way that is compatible with the way that we humans are used to it being continued. And in a sense, that's not surprising because neural nets were originally invented and modeled on the way that our brains work. We didn't know that the way our brains work were fully captured by neural nets. We had no idea that there weren't other kinds of weird features of molecular biology or whatever else that were not captured by these kind of idealized neural nets. But what's happened with ChatGPT is it's just a neural net that's made from collections of numbers and multiplying numbers and adding numbers and thresholding numbers and so on. And that gets done, in the case of ChatGPT, in the original version at least, about 200 billion times every time it produces another word. Ultimately, what it's doing is it's been trained to finish a sentence. You start a sentence, it's going to tell you how it goes on. It's going to tell you how the essay goes on for many words if you let it do that. And this is its fundamental thing, is continue the text in a way that is typical of the text that humans have written out there on the web. So it's encapsulating whatever it is that we humans have put out there. It's reflecting back to us an encapsulation of what we put out there. But it's encapsulating, it's putting back the language that we put out there. When you say, okay, do a mathematical computation, well, if it's seen examples of that computation a bunch of times on the web, it will be able to more or less reproduce it. A lot of times, it will talk nonsense because it will say, well, I roughly saw that the thing produced a number with such and such a number of digits. I wasn't really able to compute exactly what those digits were, but I know it's roughly this number of digits. I'm going to produce that result. It's actually a little bit terrible for the humans because you look at it, you say, oh yeah, that sounds right. And yes, it does sound right because it's like roughly what's on the web. But when you look at it in detail, it's like, oh my gosh, it's not actually right. I mean, to your experience of your arithmetic game, it managed to get it right at the point where you didn't have to do real counting or computation. It's just like, oh, I can remember a few numbers. When it actually has to compute something, that's not what it can do. Now, for example, we built a plugin for ChatGPT with OpenAI that connects to our whole computation framework, and that will be able to do those computations. In that case, what's happening is ChatGPT is figuring out, oh yeah, I've got something I have to compute here. All right, let me call this Wolfram thing to go and compute it. Then it goes off into our whole computational framework, and then it's like, okay, I need to work out, is this a prime number, whatever else. We can do that as a computational matter. Then we're feeding that back to ChatGPT and saying, here's a piece of text that represents the answer to that. And then it goes happily along and makes use of that fact. I mean, it's kind of using a tool like we humans would use a tool. I mean, if somebody said to me, at least, what's the 1,015th prime number? I would have no idea. I could type it into software I'd built and it would immediately tell me, but that wouldn't be something that I would expect to work out just off the top of my head. That's another thing to realize about large language models is what humans can do off the top of their head, it's going to be able to do. What humans say, oh, I need to go use a computer, I need to look this up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the kinds of things it's not likely to be able to do.
So once we get a grasp on more or less what it is, we realize that, let's imagine, for example, that in mathematics, there's some proposition that mathematicians feel like can probably be proven, but up to now, they haven't been able to prove it. There's no way a ChatGPT could prove that, because where would it get the answer from?
That's largely true. I mean, there are things where there's sort of mathematical intuition about roughly what might this be related to. Now, it's possible by reading the literature, it might notice, by reading the mathematical literature, it might notice, oh, there are these class of problems where this thing is like that thing is like that thing. These are essentially linguistic observations. And it is quite possible that it could figure things out that way. So, for example, a lot of important theoretical science kinds of ideas come about through an analogy between one field and another. You have an analogy between, I don't know, one that I've studied recently is between metamathematics and the theory of space-time. These are very different fields, but yet that turns out to be an analogy. Now, that analogy, I think, is conceivable that that analogy could be deduced by reading, oh, the things about metamathematics work this way, and this follows from that, and this is connected to that. And that human kind of relatable analogy, I think, is conceivably accessible. If you say, no, can you do an automated proof of this theorem? Not a chance. Not what it does. The only place where it has any potential, somewhat unproved, is when you are trying to say, oh, I'm going to prove this theorem. I have this axiom. I'm going to apply this axiom, then this one, then this one. I'm going to pick a path which gets me from the thing I started from to the theorem I wanted to prove. And often there's a question of, do you go that way on the path or do you go the other way on the path? And making good choices about intermediate branches on the path is important to seeing whether you get to the final result. And one thing people have done lots of experiments with, we've done these too, is can you make use of the heuristics that a large language model learnt from human language and apply them in what's the most likely way that this path is going to end up with something good? The reason that's not totally crazy is the following. When you're doing kind of mathematics, one of the things that's important is it's not that hard to generate arbitrary theorems. What's not obvious is which of those theorems humans are going to care about. You can just write down some, you can automatically generate all kinds of formal mathematical results, but they may be results off in some direction where humans would just say, well, that's amusing, but we don't really care. It doesn't really relate to anything we're doing. It's kind of like there might be a geographic territory where people say, well, it's nice that Antarctica exists, but we're not actually going to build cities there because it's not a place we want to hang out and colonize. And it's the same kind of thing in mathematical space. So that's a place where it is conceivable that something which kind of knows our preferences from knowing billions of pages of language we've written could have some hope of providing insight. But for the most part, you're absolutely right that when it comes to the machinery of science, a large language model is not what you want to use to progress with the machinery of science, so to speak.
I'd like to try to understand a result that a number of my academic colleagues have been getting with ChatGPT. So if I were to ask it, name for me a few of the most influential books in economics in the 20th century, I'm sure it would tell me John Maynard Keynes's General Theory, maybe it would give me Alfred Marshall, and we would have no problem doing that. But if I asked it about some obscure corner of marine biology, well, then it's not that it comes back and says, I'm sorry, but I'm up against the limitations of my knowledge. Instead, I get completely fabricated results. Is it possible to tweak this thing so that at some point it becomes capable of acknowledging its limitations? I have observed it fabricating bibliographical sources out of whole cloth.
It's a subject of very active research. I mean, literally every few days, there's another sort of academic effort to try and do this, to try and know when. And so one of the recent ones had to do with, if you just watch the inside of the neural net, people have observed that, I don't know if it's correct, but people claim that when it's lying, certain parts of the neural net are more active than when it's telling the truth, so to speak. It's like the lie detector for the neural nets. Whether that will work out, I don't know. This question of does it know when it knows, it's not self-evident that it wouldn't know when it knows, so to speak. It's not built into the nature of the thing that it can't know when it doesn't know, so to speak. The actual way it's been built so far, it doesn't have that capability. I think one thing a lot of people believe, including myself, is that what's been put into ChatGPT now is really three things. It's the structure of language, a certain amount of common sense knowledge, and a whole bunch of actual detailed facts. Who was John Maynard Keynes? What was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those detailed facts don't really belong in the large language model. To know, you know, how old was John Maynard Keynes when he died, it's not really something that is relevant to putting together an essay. It's something where you need to go look it up to be able to find that knowledge, but you don't need it to conceptualize the structure of a typical essay. And so I think what we'll probably see happen is that the actual layer of kind of the linguistic user interface that is the large language model will be something much thinner, something which really just encapsulates language as it is, a certain amount of common sense knowledge needed to make sensible versions of language. And then it'll be up to, well, folks like us who build kind of computational knowledge systems, or the main computational knowledge system actually that exists. And it'll be up to computational knowledge systems to feed in the actual detailed facts into the system. If that works out, it has a lot of consequences. Because like right now, these large language models, they're big. They're not readily runnable on your average personal computer. If one can factor out the pure language part from the big facts part, it is much more plausible that these are things that can be run by individual people on their own computers, not centralized, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it changes some of the use cases for these systems are significantly changed by the ability to have kind of the thing running privately versus the thing running in some central place and so on. But my guess is that's what we'll eventually see happen. How quickly that will happen, well, that's a question of predicting the research, which is actually hard to do in this case. Just as it was very hard to know 2023 was going to be the time when large language models reached the point of being human compatible, so to speak. I mean, I couldn't have told you within a couple of decades when that would happen. And I don't think anybody else really could have either.
And it's hard to know exactly. We can't even now predict 2025, what that's going to look like if 2023 was such a surprise to us. I'm thinking about when I was 10 years old, I was programming in the basic programming language, if you remember that.
I do.
And, you know, in elementary school, this is how they were teaching us to interact with computers. And I thought it was exciting. But I remember specifically asking my teacher, does the computer, and here I know I'm inserting a complicated word here, does the computer understand what I'm asking of it? And what my teacher said to me, it does not. He said, it just knows if he types this, you light up this. And you were asked recently about the extent to which something like a ChatGPT could be said to understand what it's saying to you. And I think you had an issue with what the idea of understanding, what we mean by that. And I think what a layman like me means is understanding, I think we can grasp from contrasting somebody who plays the piano like an automaton versus somebody who plays the piano with a comprehension of music theory, so really penetrates to the nature of the piano. That person would be said to have understanding. And I think that's what we want to know. Is there ever a machine that could penetrate to that level?
What you're sort of implying there is, imagine that we looked at your brain when you were playing the piano. Is what you're seeing in your brain just this little circuit that's activating that says, you know, play the next note, play the next note? Or is there some bigger, is it in training a larger part of your whole mental structure of doing this? And I think that's a complicated question for a large language model. So it was a question for a long time, can a machine understand natural language? You know, if you give it a sentence, can it, quotes, understand that? That was a thing that had confused people for a long time. People had tried to do that. What does it mean to understand it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Back in 2009, when we brought out our Wolfram Alpha system, that was a case where for the first time one had a real definition of what it operationally meant to understand the natural language, which was you type in a natural language question, what's the ratio of the populations of Boston and New York or something? And what Wolfram Alpha does is it translates that to this precise computational language. the entity New York, the population property of that divided by the entity Boston, population property of that, and so on. It's a precise formal kind of thing. So what operationally one means in that case by understanding is we went from the natural language to this computational representation, and from the computational representation, we can then compute whatever we want to compute. So I think it sort of relates to the kind of way of thinking about what's happening in a brain when you're playing music. Do you get the sort of full depth of what you can work out from music, or do you merely get the surface level of this is the next note, this is the next note, and so on? And I think, I mean, there will be things, this question of what's the comparison between how many neurons light up in our brains when we say what we're going to say versus how many neurons light up in the large language model's brain when it says the next thing. There are some aspects of large language models which are distinctly different from brains. And they're partly this whole thing of it's generating a word at a time. It's just flowing through this kind of mathematical structure every time it generates a word. It doesn't plan what it's going to say. The only way that it maintains continuity is that every successive word it produces, it's looking back at all the previous words it produced and seeing the pattern of those to work out the next word. There are things we're pretty sure happen in brains that involve not just this kind of feed forward of generate the next word, but also a certain amount of feeding back of informing the system more about how to do that planning. It's not clear how this works in neuroscience, but there's at least some evidence that there are additional things going on. So I think we'll see more, probably a greater depth of more neurons involved, more things lighting up as more language is produced. And we'll see also this very non-human thing of computations happening, where you can go to sort of arbitrary depths of computation, something we humans are not able to do, something we humans are really bad at doing. If you say to a person, take even maybe a basic program, you might be able to run it in your head. But if you take more complicated programs, nobody can run those in their head, so to speak. You use a computer to run those things. It's not something where you expect to have the sort of whole loop of computation happening directly in your brain. But I think the thing to understand about the difference between the programming language model, what BASIC does, and the kind of thing that a large language model does, there are a number of important differences. I mean, one is the kind of the concept of how you use a language like BASIC is it has certain primitive operations that are things that relate to things that were built into the computer, and you engineer what your program should say based on knowing, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. I can foresee in advance what's going to happen when I put down that step in the program. Whereas what we're seeing with these more complicated computational systems, including large language models, is that's no longer the case. You can't readily foresee in advance what the system is going to do. You just basically have to run it and see what happens. And that's a very different form of kind of interaction with a machine than we've been used to. It's something that is not that different from our interaction with, for example, the natural world. Until you know the science of how something works, you just say, well, if I plant this plant in this way, then I find out 3 months later that it's growing in that way. It's not something where I can have a mechanistic model of what's going to happen.
These examples I'm about to give may seem silly, but I don't think they are, actually, because I think maybe it can help at least me and other laymen understand a bit better what's going on here. If I say roses are red, violets are, we all know the next word is blue. And so the way that I've understood what's going on with ChatGPT is that ChatGPT is more or less that kind of thing on an astronomically more complicated scale. But if that were true, if that's all it is, and obviously that's just a very, very crude approximation, then it's harder to explain how I'm able to ask it to write me a poem and it knows how to rhyme the words. It actually can rhyme words. Or I can ask it to compose a haiku and it knows how to count the syllables. It's not like it's seen, maybe it has seen a billion haikus, I don't know. Or I can tell it, order my children to clean their rooms, but do so in the manner of a pirate. And it will adopt the voice of a pirate. Yep. It seems hard to reconcile that with the simple roses are red, violets are blank.
Yes. I mean, this is the amazing thing about computation. computation is something that sort of transcends what we humans are used to. Say, I'm going to have this system. It's going to operate according to these rules. Okay, I look at these rules. I say, oh yeah, I understand how these rules work. Then the human assumption is, I'll understand everything about what the system does. That just turns out not to be true. And this is another example of that phenomenon, that you are saying, I've got this rule, it's got to work this way. But then it turns out when you apply it enough times, it does something that is something you can't foresee, and it's doing something beyond what you expected to do. Now, if you ask me, how does it manage to rhyme the poem, set up the haiku correctly, I can offer a pretty decent hypothesis for how, in the internal structure of ChatGPT, it has learnt the appropriate kind of patterns of English. It has a certain size of context, a few thousand words. If the thing is a pattern that sort of fits in a few thousand words, it has a good chance to be able to reproduce that pattern. The thing that is difficult for us humans to grasp is this point that even though the setup for the thing is simple, even though we think we understand the component parts, the whole is really something beyond what we can imagine from those parts. And that's, I think, a sort of a fundamental fact about computation. It's a fundamental fact that not only affects how can ChatGPT possibly work, it affects, I think, a lot of our thinking about, well, I think it's going to be an increasingly important issue in kind of the way the world is set up, actually, because there's this kind of idea of, can you just set up rules for things and then scientifically predict what's going to happen? Or does that not really work? Is it the case that just you know the rules, but you can't scientifically foresee what's going to come out? You basically just have to follow the rules and see what happens. That's a thing which people have had this idea. It's a few hundred year old conceit, so to speak, that we're going to figure everything out with science. What does this mean? To many people, it means we're going to be able to predict everything. We're going to be able to say, we know how the system works. We're going to be able to say, in 3 months, this is going to happen. And that's something science can predict. The thing that we've learned, something I've worked on a lot in sort of theory of things, is this fundamental fact from computation. I call it computational irreducibility. This phenomenon that just because you know the rules, you might have an irreducible amount of computational work that you need to do to work out their consequences. Yes, you can follow the rules step by step, you know, a billion steps or something, and see what happens. But if you say, I want a scientific prediction, I want to be able to just write down a formula, figure out something in science, and jump ahead and say, I know what's going to happen a billion steps from now, that's something that from within science, we're learning is not possible, which I think is a very important conceptual realization, because it's something where, as I say, for the last few hundred years, there's been very much this idea that whatever we need to know about the world, science is eventually going to answer that question for us. Whatever we need to set up in the world, where we say we're going to set things up so nothing could possibly go wrong and things are going to work this way and that way, that's a plausible thing where we could say we're going to move these knobs and levers and science is going to show us that sort of nothing could possibly go wrong, so to speak. And the realization from computational irreducibility is it doesn't work that way. And science itself is telling us it doesn't work that way. It's not external mysticism, not believing in science. It's from within science itself. We're learning that. And what we see in this kind of the surprise of the fact that ChatGPT is on the more complicated end of systems of rules and so on, but the fact that we can get these things that seem so elaborate and human and so on is a thing that is part of the sort of surprise of computational irreducibility.
The word surprise, you said earlier that even the creators of ChatGPT were surprised to some extent with the results of it. Have there been other areas of AI where AI has appeared to be able to do things that even its creators are surprised that it's able to do?
So the history of AI is a mottled one. I mean, AI, the term was invented in the 1950s. At the beginning, the big surprise was that things they thought were going to work didn't work. At the beginning, people just imagined, oh, we've made mechanical devices that are stronger than humans. We'll make giant electronic brains and they'll be better than human brains. And if you go into the 1960s, people were imagining, like in the Cold War period, there was this wonderful belief that we better have automated translation because, gosh, if there's a human translator in the room, translating between these heads of state, the translator might throw everything off as a human. But if we have the machine translation, it's going to not do that. Of course, machine translation didn't work in the 1960s. People were off by many decades in when that would work. And so at the beginning, there were many disappointments in AI. This idea of neural nets actually dates from 1943. The things that are inside ChatGPT, that kind of computational structure with many engineering innovations, but the basic structure was created by a couple of people in 1943. And people had tried to use neural nets ever since 1943. People in the 1950s, people started using them for various kinds of vision tasks. There was a considerable military use of these things, all sorts of other places. They sort of gradually bubbled along doing specific things, you know, recognizing digits, handwritten digits. That was one application that sort of started to work in the 1970s, 1980s. Okay. For people like me, you know, I tried using neural nets around 1981. They weren't very interesting. They didn't do anything very impressive. I kind of thought this is never going to work. And the first, I would say, really, the big surprise, there was a big surprise at the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, when neural nets started to be able to recognize images in a way that nobody had really expected they would. And in fact, there'd been a particular person had been really, his group had really been pursuing this idea of deep learning for many, many years. And it didn't seem to be doing much. And then somebody, almost by mistake, left one of these networks training for another month of computer time, not knowing what was going to happen. They come back a month later, and by golly, now it can recognize 5,000 different kinds of things, of cats and dogs and elephants and all kinds of things like that. Whereas before, people had been able to get neural nets to recognize letters of the alphabet and so on, but not thousands of different kinds of objects. So that was the first big surprise, 2012, of yes, neural nets did something really surprising people didn't expect. Then there have been a series of further advances, which were a little less surprising, things like speech to text, which people had always thought had to be done by other methods. Neural nets managed to do it. And the thing that is always strange about neural nets is it feels like a very brute force technique. I mean, it just says, you put down this structure of all these numbers and multiplications and additions and so on, and you put down the structure, and then you just give it a zillion examples, where a zillion might be millions or billions of examples. You just say, okay, neural net, adapt the details of the numbers inside you so that you do better and better at actually reproducing the results you are supposed to get based on these examples. And it's a very, very brute force seeming. And the thing that is the surprise that people didn't expect, I certainly didn't expect, was that a very bizarre fact, the harder the problem, the easier it is for a neural net to learn. And that's a weird thing. People had imagined that, like in most areas of science, you kind of simplify the problem, you can understand what's going on. You know, you make a neural net that's just recognizing these very simple cases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Turns out when you try and train a neural net like that, it often gets stuck. It gets, oh yeah, it can recognize this one piece, but it never manages to get the other pieces and so on. The big surprise is when you're training a neural net on these really complicated problems, like how do you distinguish a cat from a dog? How do you do, you know, there are lots and lots of pixels in those images. What's it going to do? It turns out that the, quote, high dimensional problem is ultimately easier to solve, which people didn't expect, than the simplified problem. So that was the thing that repeated itself over the course of the 2010s, basically, in a series of different areas, whether it was speech to text, other kinds of things. Then this idea of image generation, given a textual prompt, can you generate a plausible image of a cat and so on? Each of these things, in a sense, the brute force methods seem to work. And by the way, the same is true with ChatGPT. ChatGPT is in many ways, I mean, not to minimize the detailed engineering that's been done, but in many ways, it's a very brute force kind of thing. It's just like, feed it everything we've written on the web. Have it learn the pattern of all those things, then have it try and produce text that follows those same patterns. So I would say there are two major surprises. I mean, the 2012 deep learning surprise and the ChatGPT surprise are probably the most identifiable kind of AI surprises. You might ask, well, is there going to be another surprise coming up real soon? And I think we don't know, but I think that one of the things that is happening is we're beginning to get to the edge of the training data we have. one more big source of training data is videos of what actually happens out there in the world. How do things affect other things, and how do humans relate to each other and so on? Those are things you can learn from videos, and that hasn't yet been, it's being mined as a way to train neural nets and so on. And I have no doubt that lots of things will become possible there of sort of the human avatar-like video responding in a reasonable way to another human talking to that avatar and things like this. You know, so that's the next surprising thing. It seems to require quite a lot of computational resources. That will be a limiting factor, I think, for a while on that.
Hey, folks, with Father's Day coming up, I got a message for you from Omaha Steaks. On Father's Day, your father and a bunch of other fathers are going to compare notes, and they're going to say, what did you get for Father's Day? And one of them will say, oh, I got a number one dad t-shirt. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That's very, very sweet and nice. But he has 10 of them from the 10 previous Father's Days. Why don't you get him a countercultural, awesome gift that he secretly wants and that will make him the envy of all the other dads? Your father or father-in-law or whoever is going to say, I got a hand-selected package from Omaha Steaks. You go over to omahasteaks.com, use promo code Woods at checkout. You get $30 off your qualifying order. These packages can include bacon-wrapped filet mignons, air-chilled boneless chicken breasts, burgers, jumbo franks, many more favorites. I've been eating them myself because Omaha Steaks sent me an amazing package just like the kind that you can make for your own dad. And it's delicious as always. I've been ordering Omaha Steaks since maybe 2010. It's super convenient, top quality, and a great value. Well, whether he's your father, father-in-law, or father figure, he's the guy who was always ready to step up when you needed him most. This Father's Day, show him the love with the only gift that's as unforgettable as he is, the mouth-watering perfection of Omaha Steaks. From perfectly aged, oh-so-tender steaks to hand-selected gift packages, Omaha Steaks makes it easy to give dad what he really wants. Order today and get $30 off with promo code WOODS. And every purchase is backed by their unconditional money-back guarantee. That's omahasteaks.com. Promo code WOODS. Minimum order may be required. See site for details.
How would you describe to a lay audience Wolfram language and its applications?
Okay, let's start with a kind of an analogy, which is people are often surprised that ChatGPT can do a certain amount of logic. It can say if P implies Q and Q implies R, then, you know, P implies R, whatever else. The thing that's interesting is it learned logic the same way that Aristotle figured out logic. That is, Aristotle looked at, presumably, lots of examples of rhetoric and things like this and said, these are patterns of how arguments follow, how the pieces of arguments follow from each other, and said, okay, but we can abstract from that. Instead of having this be a discussion about a turtle and an elephant, it can be a discussion about a P and a Q, and P and Q can stand for anything. And logic was one of the first examples of kind of lifting above kind of natural language, lifting something formal above natural language, lifting something which has a kind of formal structure that is independent of the particular details of a language. And that's kind of an early part of the whole story of science and mathematics, is can you go from all the details of the world to kind of lift this formal structure? What's the point of doing that? The point of doing that is, once you have things formalized, you can expect to build a whole tower of consequences. When you just have, oh, I've got the statement, the turtle is smaller than the elephant or something, and you kind of roughly say that and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it's hard to go on and deduce, it's hard to get this whole sort of tower of, so what are the consequences of that? What are the consequences of that? And not have the thing be rickety, because something that you were talking about down at the base of the tower was something that was ambiguous in the language, and it didn't really, you weren't able to solidly build it up. So the big point is, can you formalize the world? Can you take things about the world and make them precise, make them something where you can expect to deduce from this to that to the other thing? And that's something that has been successfully done in mathematics. Mathematics has gone a long way beyond the kind of mere discussion of, oh, well, I've got two dogs and three dogs, and that makes five dogs type thing. You have the abstract 2 + 3 = 5, and then you go far beyond that. And essentially what made that possible was an invention about 500 years ago of mathematical notation. Before that time, when people had wanted to talk about mathematical kinds of things, they did it with natural language. But then people invented plus signs and equal signs and all those kinds of things. And that kind of launched this kind of streamlined way to talk about mathematics in a formal fashion. And that's what launched algebra and then calculus and basically modern mathematical science and engineering. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to do the same kind of thing, but bigger. We're trying to say, let's take things that exist in the world. Are they cities? Are they paths on the surface of the earth? Are they chemicals? Are they molecules? Any of these kinds of things, and have a computational representation, a precise computational representation of these things. And if we know something about, oh, we know, given these two positions on the earth, we know what the distance between these is because we can work that out using spherical trigonometry and things like this. We know the procedure for doing that, encapsulate that. So the idea of Orthon language is to provide kind of a notation for talking about the world precisely and computationally. And then the big bonus is, once we are able to do that, we're able to get a computer to compute things about what we figured out for us. So once we have a computational representation of an image, for example, once we have a computational representation of the idea of a human face or something like that, then the computer automatically figure out, okay, where are the faces in this? Let's work out how many faces there are here, all those kinds of things. And what our goal, my goal for the last 40 years or so, has been to kind of make as much as possible about the world computational, in a sense, formal and precise, so that we can build these towers of capability in the way that mathematics has been able to build a tower of capability that's led to modern mathematical science and engineering. What that means operationally is, pick a field like history, for example. And then the question is there a, for any field X, is there a computational X? What does computational history look like? What does that even mean? Well, in Orthon language, for example, we have lots of data. We have data on, I don't know, maybe 5,000 battles that have happened in the history of our civilization, so to speak. We know where they are. We know if whatever the sort of some basic historical account of what happened in that battle. Okay, so you can say, well, I wonder how much of this war took place in this place. Well, you might have a words version of that, but you might also just be able to say, okay, these are the geopositions of those things. Let's make a map. That's easy. Let's say, did this roughly move from the east to the west? Is that something we can see in the sort of deduce from the structure of these things? Or for example, you might say, let's look at the rise and fall of empires or something. And it's kind of amazing to see the sort of computational version of human history play out of, you know, the borders of countries, that a country will get bigger, 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 and then it will sort of pop and come down to nothing, and then other things will fill in for it and so on. And you get this idea that there might be a way to think about something even as humanistic as history in a way that has a more formal character to it. Now, some of the things you may deduce from that, you may or may not care about, but it's kind of a different way. It's a way, just as mathematics introduced into physics, for example, this very different way of thinking about physics, so computation in general introduces into pretty much all areas a way of formalizing things, a way of clarifying one's thoughts. I mean, this is one of the great things about mathematics, is that there's a certain precision and discipline of thinking that mathematics gives one. From Plato on, people were enthusiastic about the idea that mathematics is a place where it's just true. There's no human argument about it. It's just a thing you can formally deduce as true. And so what computation does, is it, and computational language does, is it gives you this way of formalizing questions and things one can work out about the world. And the things one can work out may be different from the things one cared about before, just as they were when mathematics was introduced and so on. So, I mean, as a practical matter, what's happening is pretty interesting with LLMs and ChatGPT and things like this, is it used to be the case up until a few months ago that if you wanted to write Orthon language, if you wanted to write this computational language, you had to be able to do that from scratch, sort of know the words in the computational language and be able to string them together in a meaningful way. Just as if you want to write something about mathematics, you have to know how to write down these mathematical symbols and so on. The really interesting thing that now seems to be possible is you can just walk up to a computer and start typing natural language and expect to create a piece of computational language. The thing that is the modern workflow, and I say modern, when I say modern, I mean a few weeks modern, not modern as in this decade or something. You type something in, you generate a piece of code. The whole point of Wolfram Language Code is it's a computational representation of the things we think about. It is a language that we can read as well as write. So the machine generates some piece of computational language. You as a human can look at it and say, is that really what I meant? It's much easier to read it than it would be to write it from scratch. Just like you're trying to understand some foreign language in human language, it's easier to read than it is to compose that language for yourself. And this is the unique case where we've got this computational language where it's intended for humans to read. So I think the modern workflow of things is you're typing to the machine something in human natural language, it's synthesizing some computational language, you read that, maybe you tweak it a bit, and then you start building on that. So one of the questions that then comes up is, okay, that means lots of exercises that people have gone through school to learn how to do and all this kind of thing, the machine can do it now. But there's one piece that's really missing. So what do you actually want to compute to begin with? How do you conceptualize things so that you can define what it is you want to tell the machine to do? And I think that's a sort of an interesting moment in education, because I think there's been a tremendous sort of tendency towards increasing specialization and so on. And this is a case where what really matters is to have the big picture. What are you trying to ask? How do you formulate what you're trying to talk about, more so than do I know the mechanics of how to actually do that particular computation and so on? I think that's the coming sort of literacy is, do you understand how to think about the world computationally? By the way, something I find rather charming is, you know, prompt engineering has become this very big ticket thing of, you know, who can write the right prompt for a large language model to get it to do the right thing, okay? So one question I've been curious about is, what is the human skill, you know, what is the transferable skill that leads you to be a good prompt engineer? Is it that you understand mathematics, that you understand computational linguistics? What is it? I'm pretty sure the answer is that you're a good expository writer. That basically, when I notice this for myself, you know, when I write a prompt and I'm kind of lazy and I don't really say, well, let me explain this really clearly, by golly, it doesn't understand, just as humans wouldn't understand. And when I do a good job of the expository writing, because it's modeled on human understanding, we talked a little bit before about what it means to understand, but operationally, does it do what I want it to do, so to speak? And the answer is, if I explain myself clearly enough, it has a much better chance to do that. But again, the real sort of pivot point is, do I know what I want it to do in the first place? Have I conceptualized what I want it to do in the first place? Sort of that's the big challenge of people getting to the point where that has been broadly understood. And it's an unbelievably minority kind of thing to understand at this point.
I feel like I can't wrap up this conversation without asking you to make some value judgments, because up to now, our discussion has been more or less purely descriptive, but people have fears, some justified, perhaps some unjustified, about AI. And I wonder if you can give us everything has pluses and minuses. Can you give us an overview? And I know that you've written an enormous amount on that. I've been reading a bunch of your articles. In fact, the question of, is AI going to take all our jobs? I'm just going to link people to your article on that on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/2339. But can you assess for us the pluses and minuses for civilization, for human flourishing of AI as you see it developing?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is a change over the course of human history is technology and automation. I mean, if we look at, you go look at a Greek play or something, the human condition is very little different from the way it always was. And the way we humans act as humans is very little different. But the thing that has been this constant change over human history is technology and the number of things that we as humans don't have to do ourselves, but we can kind of delegate to automation. AI is another step of that. It's a surprise to people that a lot of kind of knowledge work types of activities where people said, that's not a thing we're going to be able to delegate to machines. People have believed that for decades at least, that that's something that is really, that's a human thing. We're never going to be able to get machines to do that. Well, rather suddenly, and it's a very rare thing in the history of technology and so on, that a thing like this happens as suddenly as this has happened. So I think people are still reeling from the realization that, well, yes, there are a lot of things which we thought humans had to do, and they don't have to do it. And I think now the question of what will be the result of that, does that mean there are no jobs for humans, there's nothing for humans to do? I doubt that. That is not what we've seen historically. I doubt that's what we'll see in this case. I think what we'll see is, well, there's lots of stuff. For example, I talked about, well, things like low-level programming. A lot of that will disappear because it's really automatable. I mean, people like me have pushed that automation for decades. So that part is not a surprise to somebody like me, that that's an automatable thing. But to many people, that's a surprise. So then the question is, so when that becomes automated and programming is free, so to speak, what does that then mean? Well, it means that people who were just doing the programming, they don't get to do that anymore because nobody needs that. It's just automated. But now there's this vast number of new things that can be done because the programming part was free, so to speak. And I think that's the typical thing you see historically, is something gets automated, and then the result is that a thing that used to be a single activity that people had to put a lot of effort into fragments into a zillion different new innovated activities, so to speak. And humans, one of the challenges is always, well, what do we want to do? There's a lot that is computationally in principle possible. The question is, which things of all the things that we might consider, whether it's doing podcasts, whether it's playing buzz games, whether it's doing this, whether it's doing that, this question of what do we choose to do is a question that is quintessentially human. There's nothing that's going to tell us there's a mathematical theorem that proves you have to play this kind of fortunately, unfortunately game or something like this. That's a human kind of choice to decide that that's something that's worth pursuing. And I think what automation does is it sort of opens up more possibilities for kind of different human choices. And that's a place where we humans are definitely in the loop in making those choices. There isn't sort of an abstract way to make those choices. So I think in terms of, you know, will automation make the world a richer place, richer in the sense of more things for people to do, more interesting things for people to do? I think the answer is absolutely yes. Will it be the case that there's this kind of terrible divide between the people who understand this stuff and the people who don't understand this stuff? I think actually this is going to bring those two parts much closer together. I think that the technical tower that you need to understand to sort of be functional in some particular area just got substantially automated away. What becomes important is the global understanding. It isn't the technical detail, the thing that you had to get the PhD to learn about, so to speak. So in some sense, I think that's an interesting moment because it does give the opportunity, just like the expository writers as prompt engineers, the expository writers with no, quote, detailed technical knowledge and technical background and so on. That's sort of an interesting mixing point for the world. I think in a different branch of kind of, should we be worried about the AIs? There's also the question of, okay, well, what are we going to delegate to the AIs? And are the AIs going to do what we want them to do? That's a challenging question. It's not helped by the question of, so what do we want the AIs to do? That is, if we give a system of ethics, for example, for the AIs, if we tell them, oh, you're ranking posts on social media, you should think about the following ethical question when you do that. You know, if we can decide what we want those principles to be, then the AI has a fighting chance of being able to follow them. But first we have to, it's shining a kind of bright light on, so what do we actually want? Because while it's just a question of telling people, well, do roughly this, do roughly that, it's kind of, you always know there's a certain fuzziness to what the people will do, so to speak. But by the time you have the AI and you can see these were the prompts that were given to the AI, well, there's a certain amount of fuzziness for the AI as well, but these were the specific prompts. And then The AI was the thing that decided which way to drive the self-driving car. The AI was the thing that decided how to change the bank interest rates. The AI was the thing that decided this or that. And then you say, well, let's look at the prompts. Well, you can concretely do that. So I think, you know, this question of, so what do we want the AIs to do? And people will say, well, we want the AIs to do the right things or things that are good for humans or whatever. There's a tremendous issue there in, so what do we actually want? And I know one of the things that is certainly locally sort of a risk is a lot of these things will get implemented just by virtue of, well, there's an engineering piece of engineering that has to get done, and this is how this will be implemented. And one might be concerned about the kind of depth of almost philosophical thinking that goes on in trying to figure out how should those things be set up. Because like a very typical thing, people will say, well, let's just have the AIs watch what humans do, and we'll have them learn from the humans by some machine learning training how to act. And then people say, very quickly say, no, that's a really bad idea. Humans do a lot of crazy stuff that we absolutely don't want the AIs to do. And so then you get into the kind of question of, well, we want the AIs to do what humans aspire to do. And that's a big mess because people don't agree on what humans aspire to do. And that's a place where there's an issue. Then the question is, to what extent can you get the AIs to do what you tell them to do? Well, I think there's a couple of things to realize there. One is some part of what AIs do is actuating things in the real world, like turning the steering of the self-driving car in that direction, changing this quantitative number in this way. In those cases, you can always say, okay, AI, I don't know what you're thinking inside, but we're going to just control something about what happens on the outside. No, you can't slam the brakes on of the self-driving car at this rate because, you know, that's going to be bad for everybody, whatever else. It's something where you can take the output from the AI and you can put constraints on the output from the AI. There's one thing, I realized this recently, it's a terrible thing, that there's one form of actuation for AIs that is almost by definition not controllable, which is the AIs are interacting with humans. That's sort of the point. The AIs are feeding whatever it is, news feeds to humans. The AIs are making suggestions to humans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Humans are an actuation layer for AIs. So if the AIs learn this is what you do to actuate the humans to do this or that thing, then even if you say, great, we're going to control the actuation layer, we're going to make sure that nothing crazy happens at the actuation layer, you don't get to do that because one of the important actuation layers is humans, who they do what they do. They're controlled by governments, laws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not, it's not something where you can say, I'm going to put this little piece of code in there that's going to make sure that the self-driving car doesn't drive into a brick wall or something. It's a tricky thing. And I think there are a lot of dynamics of how that works that will play out over the next few years, probably. And I would say that the thing that the more people understand, the deeper ideas about what it means to have an AI-governed world, the more that that's generally understood, the more people really engage with kind of ideas like computational irreducibility that understand that, no, you can't know just because you look at the code doesn't mean you can know what's going to happen, those kinds of things. The more people understand that, the more there's likely to be sort of meaningful discourse about what to do, and it's not clear what to do. I think the one thing that I would say, I mean, my own sort of perhaps prejudice, I don't know, is the first step is just define, you say, okay, we're going to have an AI constitution, or each community is going to have a different AI constitution. Well, the question is, what are even the clauses in that constitution? What's a plausible clause? Maybe you come up with 200 plausible clauses and you can say, well, I'll pick number 42. Somebody else will pick number 97. You say, well, actually, you can't pick both 42 and 97. They're inconsistent with each other. But you can then at least have a reasonable sort of form of discourse about, so what should one do, so to speak? But one doesn't even know very much about what the content of such a thing would look like. So I think that's an area of issue. I mean, there are other things that are an issue. I think this whole question about centralization versus decentralization of the operation of AIs, there has been a trend for a while. The social media, the search engines, all these kinds of things are very centralized. That's been a thing that has had, there's a certain amount of consequences to that centralization. The question is AI centralized as well, or is AI decentralized? And that, I think, is still technically somewhat up in the air. I would say another thing is in the area of education, there's a lot of potential in education. There's a lot of potential to provide much more personalized education. There's a lot of ability for an AI to know what I know. And so when I want to learn a new thing, it can tell me just the exact right thing to tell me because it knows what I already know. It knows how to take the scaffolding I already have and add that piece onto it rather than just saying, well, let me tell you the same as I'm going to tell everybody else and not take account of what I already know. So I think there are a lot of interesting opportunities there. There's some risk because there are things where it's worse than teach to the test. It's teach to the AI, so to speak. It's like learn to write your essay so that the AI will grade it well and so on. There are certainly issues around that. And at what point the humans are pretty much just in the service of the AIs, which is, from at least my point of view, not a good outcome. I like the human choices that we get to make. I'm not so into the idea that everything I do will be auto-suggested by an AI.
As we wrap up, I guess one final thing. There is a concern that was raised the last time I did an episode on this. Somebody said, if we begin to offload more and more intellectual tasks onto AI, because I no longer have to learn how to write an essay because AI can write the essay for me, isn't there a fear that we become, well, frankly, stupider, more easily manipulated? We have more difficulty discriminating between truth and propaganda because the AI can do it for us. The AI can do all the thinking for us.
This is the thing that, yes, once you've defined a question, maybe the AI can do a good job of answering it. But what about defining the question? That becomes much more the role of humans, the role of education to teach humans how to do that. I think that the kind of thinking broadly and critically is something that actually we should and probably will get to do more of because the technical detail has been automated away. And people always say this. I myself have spent some part of my life building tools that automate a lot of kinds of computational things people do. And it's the concern, oh gosh, if people don't do integrals by hand anymore, nobody will know how to do an integral anymore. Well, turns out there's an interesting other effect. If you do 1,000 integrals by computer, you get all sorts of interesting intuition about how integrals work, which you would have never had by doing 25 integrals by hand. It's kind of a different, you get a higher level picture, you get sort of a higher level set of thoughts that you can have because you automated away kind of the technical detail. I think that's going to happen in lots of areas. That can happen in lots of areas. Now, people may just say, gosh, I'll just do what the AI says. It's kind of like, I forgot how to read maps because I just follow my GPS. And sometimes my GPS tells me to do stupid things. And it's a bit of a jarring moment when you realize this GPS is doing something completely crazy. I actually now have to think about some piece of geographic thinking, so to speak. And I'm actually quite optimistic about the extent to which people will be more interested in truly human sort of broad thinking as a result of increased automation than that people will be like, yes, I can. I would say that one of the things about writing essays that's a little bit of a special case is that essays are a way of crystallizing thoughts. They're a way of us figuring out what on earth are we really talking about. There are other ways. Writing computational language is another way. Writing mathematics is another way. These are ways of expressing ourselves that sort of allow us to clarify our thoughts. And the clarification of thoughts is something that's absolutely going to be critically necessary in telling the AIs what to do. It will be, you know, can you get away with never having a thought about what you want to do, just following the stream of what everybody else tells you to do or what the system tells you to do? Yes, there are people who do that, but I don't think that will be, I think the norm will tend to be that the set of people who can exercise their sort of human thinking abilities will be broadened by the fact that people don't say, oh gosh, I can't do anything with computers because I didn't learn to program. That won't be an excuse anymore. You can expect to broaden out the people who have access to the most powerful kind of ideas and tools that our civilization has come up with. That has been something that's been very bottled up in a place where you kind of have to spend a decade of your life learning to get to that point in the tower that you can use these things. I think that's something we can expect to get greatly opened up. And that's an exciting thing. My feeling is, if anything, people will get better at thinking broadly and deeply than they have been before. And they will be not as concentrated on, can I do that math problem? Can I do it faster than the other person? Or can I do this thing that's automatable in a faster way? But we'll be doing these things that are very human and that really involve, to me, some of the things that sort of make us most human and make us most interesting, so to speak, that involves broader and deeper thinking.
Dr. Wolfram, if people want to follow you and what you've been writing these days, what's the easiest way online for them to do that?
Let's see. You can go to my website, stephenwolfram.com, and I write lots of stuff, which winds up on writings.stephenwolfram.com. I also do, last few years, I've been doing lots of live streaming, and I do a couple of live streams every week, which are actually interactive things, which are Q&A, where people ask me questions about all kinds of things, and I do my best to try to answer. And that's a good place to try to follow. And for people who are, well, who are interested in our technology and Wolfram language and so on, wolfram.com, our corporate website, has all of that kind of information.
All right. I will put all this up at tomwoods.com/2339. I kept you longer than I said I would, but you've been very gracious, and I appreciate very much your time and your insights. Thanks so much.
Yeah, great.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.